Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
And welcome to the show. Hello, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. As we count down the last few days of 2025, we're listening back to just a couple of the great conversations from this year. Later in the hour, we'll find out why later life divorce is trending upward. An increasing number of couples over 65 are ending marriages, often after decades together.
We're framing this show as a look at intimacy and relationship trends that caught our eye this year. And another one of them was the sex recession. Basically, people are having less sex than they did a few decades ago.
A recent analysis by the Institute for Family Studies found that just 37% of American adults aged 18 to 64 are getting it in on a weekly basis. That's way down from 55% in 1990. It's married people, single people, younger people, older people. They're all having less sex.
And so we asked sex researcher Debbie Herbenick about this sex recession. She is provost professor at the Indiana University School of Public Health and director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion. What has changed over the last 35 years, and why is it pulling some couples apart?
Sometimes it is people being distracted on their devices, focusing more on the devices than the person. But what that means is also less time for human-to-human intimacy, for the conversation that kind of can wind up flirtatious, or that might, you know, just be feeling really intimate and connected. Those are the kinds of things that get people into the bedroom, right? Playfulness, yeah. Intimacy. So if you're substituting that with just kind of scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, or binge watching a TV show, that might be a lot of fun. But do you really need to see all 10 episodes in over 1 or 2 days or a full week? Those are the things that are taking people away from intimacy.
And it does feel like, Debbie, in addition to being on our devices, we're just spending maybe less physical time with one another. There's fewer of those common places where people get together and do that talking. I don't know.
In person.
Yeah, yes. In person. Is that part of what's going on here, too?
Yeah, there's good evidence that people just spend less time in social situations, less time with friends, less time just hanging out at parties and bars and things like that. And so when you do have, you know, fewer gatherings of humans, you're also going to have some less sex.
Yeah. I want to read this comment from Greg, who says the real answer, relational burnout, unaddressed mental health challenges causing people to be more tired. In some cases, access to porn on phones has numbed people out, rewired brains to self-please because it's easier. And when we extend that relational thing, I mean, we did a show recently on pornography being more accessible. I mean, a lot of people are just getting, I guess, the thing you would get from the one-on-one relationship, that sex stimulation from other things. How much is that a factor?
Yeah, I think it's another factor. I mean, I don't think we're going to find one or even two or three things that are responsible for the decline in partnered sex. It's happening in the US, in Japan, in Sweden, in the United Kingdom, in Belgium, right? I mean, it's all over where people have the data to look at it. We see it. And in terms of pornography, so I think part of it is that people have on-demand access to explicit content. But the other part that we hear a lot with internet pornography is to get the clicks, right? We think about clickbait with news. Well, clickbait happens with pornography too. And so the pornography in the 2000s became a lot more extreme. And that comes from interviews with people working in the industry, whether they're actors and actresses or producers, who said to get people to click on our videos, we had to do more extreme things that the actors in the 90s were not asked to do. So pornography got more extreme. And what we've heard in our research from people is that sometimes, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, more people were being asked by their partners to do things that they didn't feel comfortable doing. They didn't find erotic or sexy. They felt pressure on their own sexual lives. And their partners might say, this is a totally normal thing to do, right? I've seen this in like 20 porn films. Like, this isn't just like me being weird. This is what everybody, you know, like all people, all women like this or whatever. And so, I mean, I know of divorces that have happened because of things like that, of people saying this is totally normal. And then another partner saying, but this isn't what I'm going to do.
Debbie, you brought up disagreement and partners feeling uncomfortable with other partners asking for. And one thing that has changed a lot over the last century is just the social relationship between men and women. So when we're talking about heterosexual couples, the ability for one of the partners to say, like, I don't want to do this, or I don't feel obligated to have sex with you. Do we see something in the data that suggests that could be a contributing factor to people having less sex? And that's in many ways a good thing, just the idea that you have a choice and you're not obligated to have sex with your partner.
Yeah, so some of these changes are not necessarily bad, right? Mm-hmm. So whenever people get worried about declines in sexual activity, one of the things I like to point out is, like, well, what made the 1990s the gold standard, right? Oh. Like, in the 1990s, you could still have marital rape legal in some states. So that was not a gold standard, right? You could have, like, people were taking advantage of people who were drunk and not being charged with any crimes. Not the gold standard. So we don't really know what the right amount, right? The right, in air quotes, amount of sex is. And I think it's really important for people to figure that out for themselves, what feels good to them. But certainly, I think if we can move away from duty and obligation sex to sex that people truly want and feels exciting and erotic and connecting, that to me is the right direction rather than worrying about hitting a specific target of numbers.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I even think about the fact that you're talking about partnered sex, right? There's been this decline in people who are married and partners living together. How does that impact? Because it seems like when you're single, there's just less access, right?
Yeah, there's less access. So there's generally been a trend that people who are married are having more sex than single people. And generally just because they have somebody available to them, right? Like somebody who's there.
You can just roll over. There's the partner, right?
And maybe they'll say yes, maybe they'll say no. But you have, like, some chances of opportunity. And that, again, gets back to even just the social situation of the opportunity of getting out and hanging out and meeting people and having fun and being flirtatious, maybe, you know, dancing or rubbing up against somebody and thinking, like, oh, that, you know, wait a minute, like, are you feeling what I'm feeling, right? So that is part of a social situation.
Yeah.
We're talking about the fact that fewer people are coupled. And I wanted to read this quote from Derek Thompson, who writes for The Atlantic. This is one of his theories. Coupling is declining around the world as women's expectations rise and lower income men's fortunes fall. This combination is subverting the traditional role of straight marriage, in which men are seen as necessary for the economic insurance of their family. There is this idea out there, Debbie, that young men specifically are falling behind, at least where they were 10, 20, 50 years ago, and that is in some ways recalibrating the relationship between men and women, which could lead to less coupling. That's so complicated. I just wonder if there's a way to prove that is actually at the root of this somehow, because it does, you have to make sort of a couple of inferences to get there.
Yeah, I mean, So I don't think there's data that we can just pull from and say we can prove that particular thing. But I think what you're getting at that's really important, and we are having these social conversations more these days, and I think should have a long time ago, is that I do think that as a society, at least in the U.S., we haven't expected enough from boys and men. And, you know, boys and men are just these untapped resources. And I see that as a college professor. I see that, you know, there are not always expectations that, you know, young men have for each other. And I know when I read their papers, right, I read their essays, I know that they're like these thoughtful, smart, fasting men, but they will sometimes talk in their papers about feeling like, you know, that they don't think it's cool, like among their guy friends, to say that they want to have a girlfriend. They have to act like they just want to hook up. They may not even think it's cool to talk about liking to read books, right?
Wow.
Because the what's cool is to, like, say, oh, I haven't read a book in like 5 years, right? And so I think that, like, that is half of our human population. And if we can expect more of them, not only can they have the conversations about the books or the interesting things they want to, but they're also more likely to find the partners that they want to, because they're going to be more themselves and they're going to have more to say to each other.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I think that for no matter somebody's gender, like, you know, let's sort of draw them out into the people that they have the capacity to be.
Yeah. Give them space to be sensitive. Right. I want to bring in a caller. We have Ron from Philadelphia on the phone. Ron, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My question is, I'm noticing, having been married for, you know, 15 years now, there is a huge difference in the amount of time I, as a man, think about sex versus my wife. And I mean, I guess I just want, you know, I feel like as a guy, and I don't know if all guys are like this, I mean, I probably think about sex every 6 seconds. Mm. Do women, you know, think about it that often? And I doubt it. And I wonder if there is some inherent tension there. And how have you seen it, you know, play out for marriages?
Thank you. That's Ron comment. From Philadelphia. Interesting. Any disparities between the desire and thought about and around sex between the genders here?
Yeah, you know, there was some earlier research that looked at differences and kind of how often people would think about sex. Researchers would have people, like, you know, use a clicker when they had sexual thoughts. It's kind of tricky research to do, right? And get a valid response. But right. But the overall takeaway was that there probably were some gender differences and frequency of thinking about sex, especially among younger adults in their 20s and 30s, but maybe even a little bit beyond that. You know, but thinking about sex is one thing. And I think some of my challenges with that research was always, well, are you thinking about it in a good way, like in mm-hmm. a negative way, you know, like that it's something you miss or something that you're excited or erotic about? But, you know, regardless of what people's thoughts are, again, it gets back to your situation. And if you, you know, feel like you would like to be having more sex with somebody and there's something missing, I mean, that's an opportunity to talk through it with somebody mm-hmm. and to say, like, how could we get there? Because some people do just have sort of like this very, you know, they're very aware of their desire and their arousal and they're wanting to act on it. And then for other people, they are going to be what we call like responsive in their desire. So if like the right conditions are there, and like you sort of maybe start going, you start kissing, you start making out, like you may not have gone into it feeling desire, but then a couple minutes into it, if you know that that's your pattern, you might start it like that, and then you start to feel desirous and like you want to keep going.
It's interesting. I'm in a couple of group chats about with married women over 40, and sometimes you hear about the women actually feeling an increased desire at a certain mm-hmm. point, and they're the ones pulling their partners. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And it could switch. I wonder, could it just switch over time?
It can switch over time. It can switch, you know, depending. I mean, you talked about group chat over 40, and I don't know what these women are like and so on, but for some women, it's right. If you have, like, if your kids have grown up and don't need you all the time and they're not pawing at you all the time, you might now have the mental space and the physical space to respond to your desire more. I mean, I've got kids, right? And like having older kids is a lot different than having like a 2 or 4 year old who are like always on you. And like, so women with really young kids will often say, like, I am like touched out. Mm. But then when that phase of life moves on, you might have a lot, you know, you might want some more touch again. So we have these seasons all the time. And I think like that for especially long-term partners and married folks, like those are opportunities to say like, where are things at now for us? Where do we want them to be? Mm. But yeah, there is no like set gender pattern, you know, that you can count on. The genders are much more similar than they are different.
That is sex researcher Debbie Herbenik. On the other side of this break, we'll talk about how economic factors, stress, work-life balance, and even alcohol consumption might be tied to the sex recession. Or not. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation this year about the sex recession. Adults of all ages, married and single, are having less sex than they did in the 90s.
Our guest, Indiana University sex researcher Debbie Herbenik, has looked at this trend and helped us parse what could be behind it. And if a sex recession is even a bad thing. Our audience that day really identified with this topic and had a lot to say.
I want to read in a trio of comments because a mm-hmm. lot of people are making sort of similar points here, a lot of our listeners. Jack says, work-life balance has been veering toward work with a life allowance mm-hmm. for decades. These days, people are lucky to get by on just 40 hours a week of work, so people have less energy to direct towards social endeavors. None Your Business on YouTube says stress. Many people are physically and emotionally exhausted because of everything we have to do just to get by daily. And Eugene says, we too tired. So with Eugene capping it off there, I am very persuaded on some level by this, Debbie, because I think we all feel this tiredness, and it might explain why we don't want to have sex at a given time. Then I wonder, well, people must have been stressed in 1990. It wasn't like there was no stress in the world in 1990. What would explain why people would necessarily be more stressed or busy today? And is that potentially a contributing factor here?
Yeah, they're good questions. And of course, people had stress back in 1990. I mean, they did. But still, there were a lot of things about life and about work and life balance that were different. Because in 1990, you could generally, in a lot of professions, leave your work at home.
Yeah.
Right? It would be not very common to get work calls at night asking you to do things. But in the U.S. society, it is still very common in a lot of industries, not all, but in a lot of industries, to feel tethered to your email or your phone or your text after hours. In some industries, I've noticed, are really rigid about that, and they're very good about protecting people's time outside work, but others aren't. So that is another example of how technology has changed things, and it can leave people feeling all of these things going on about work, even when they have stepped away physically from their office. And of course, now we have many more people working from home, which can change how it feels. Like, is this my work? Is it my home? Right. So those are all of these shifts. And it's not a clean shift from 1990 to today.
Right.
Another change that's happened is that we're drinking less alcohol as a society.
Yeah, I didn't even think about
that.
And that
loosens
your
inhibitions.
Right.
Yeah. Some of that is positive.
Yeah.
But it also means, I mean, that we see that even with college students, like markedly, markedly less alcohol today than even like a study I did in 2015. So much less alcohol.
And then more marijuana use, I think. And I don't know if marijuana has the same effect on people or not. Like, I genuinely don't know, Debbie. Do you have any insights there?
So we were still learning about that because for decades, researchers couldn't study a lot of things with marijuana because it was illegal. So now sexuality researchers who want to study substances are catching up on issues related to cannabis because they couldn't study it before.
Yeah. Melinda on Facebook brings up proper sex education. And I was joking with Avi right before the show. When I was a kid, we had sex ed class. Everybody was on time and they had their pens and pencils ready. And I wonder about sex education these days, because those numbers are really stark when you talk about young people, and a lot of folks are abstaining longer and not, you know, even having their first experience until they're a little bit older than you did 30 years ago. And so I want to talk about sex education. What does that look like now? And does that have any impact on whether or not younger people choose to engage?
Yeah, so you said a couple of really important things here, sex education, but also sex and culture. Mm-hmm. And so one of my PhD students a couple of years ago, too, really opened my eyes, where she wanted to do a project on people who came of age in purity culture. And it wasn't something I had thought a lot about, but she really helped me see that there's a certain subset of young adults now who were raised in purity culture and were raised to think that sex was dirty. And that you didn't have sex until you were married. But now as young adults in their 20s and 30s, we're struggling with, how do I take something that felt so dirty and wrong and awful, and now I'm supposed to think it's like really lovely with my spouse, but I can't get over that feeling. And I don't want to like touch or be touched. So that's like a very active area with a lot of sex therapists now, is having clients come in who are married. Mm. But we're raised in a purity culture and are trying to put the pieces back together to have a connecting married life. And sex education, I mean, it's, you know, in the United States, it's completely split by state where you live, and then within that by school district. So, yeah, we do not have a lot of young people getting the sex education that they need. And so as a college professor, I get a lot of young people saying, I'm here because I didn't get anything growing up and I'm trying to figure it out now.
Let's bring in another caller. This is Sarah from Richboro on the line. Hey, Sarah, you're on Studio 2. What's your comment?
Yes. No, I just wanted to say that I know how I felt being a working mother. There's so much going on in a day. You come home, you have hardly any time. You're taking the kids to athletic events, or you're trying to just follow up on a bank account or a credit card bill, and you're sitting online waiting for hours.
Been there.
To get rid of someone.
Yes.
And it's just, after a while, you know, you don't do it during the week, so the weekend is the only time. And then you're kind of like, well, I kind of want that time for me.
Yeah.
I want my own time. It just becomes another chore. And then finally you're just like, well, why bother?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just going to let it go.
That's a great call. Thanks so much, Sarah.
And then 1 week
from
becomes
Richboro.
2 weeks, becomes 3 weeks, months, mm-hmm. and
totally.
It goes on. Yeah.
So this is a listener comment. I'm a 55-year-old man, and my drive has dropped dramatically due to antidepressant medication. Can you help us navigate that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, certainly SSRI antidepressants are well known for their sexual side effects, and they can change different things about sex. For some, they can create painful ejaculation. For others, dampening their desire. For others, difficulty with orgasm. And there are others, too. I mean, hormonal contraception or birth control can also have sexual side effects, although we had that in the 1990s, right. And that was actually at a higher level of hormones than the ones today. But the SSRIs are a change since the 1990s. And so on the one hand, you know, if you are depressed and you get some effective treatment for it, it can help you reengage with your friends and with partners and help awaken desire for you. But on the other hand, for some people, you know, they can have a dampening effect.
Yeah, I want to read this comment. Maura says, I think sex is a very important part to a relationship. Attraction is key, both mentally and physically. It bonds a couple and keeps the fire going. And so I want you to just, Debbie, just make the case for more sex. What does having sex do for someone? And why should we be having more? Should we be having more?
I'm going to make the case for looking at your sex life.
Yeah. Okay.
All
right.
Sex.
Go ahead.
So, yeah. And because I do think, like, if you decide that we could use some more sex, you know, in our life, then yes. I mean, the case is that it's associated actually with better health. It's associated with greater happiness. It's associated with intimacy, connection, and bonding. So absolutely, there's all those good reasons. I mean, I think that many people, when they've had a good sexual experience, they feel a little younger, a little happier, a little freer. And those all, you know, can sort of ignite energy and passion into your life and not just for the time that you're having sex. But for other people, if they don't actually feel like they need to change it and they feel really connected, you know, talking about like books or poetry or going on walks or hanging out and watching a favorite show together and just laughing. I mean, if that feels good to them, I want them to feel good. But I do think, especially right as a sexuality researcher and educator, I think this aspect of life deserves attention and care like other aspects of our life, you know, do as well.
So you should at least consider it, think about it, and not just let it become a fact in your life without at least giving it some attention and deciding whether you want more or less.
Yeah, consider it for yourself. And if you're partnered, consider it for your partner to ask them how they feel.
Yeah.
Because it can be so easy to just say, well, I'm happy with this. I've closed the door on it. You know, and we hear that from some people.
Yeah.
But if you're in a committed relationship, how does that feel for your partner? And is it okay with them? Or is there anything else that they want to adjust? Would they like to have more? And what would it look like for them? You know, it doesn't have to be the way it used to be either. Sometimes people say, yeah, I would like to have sex, but I don't really like the kinds of things we used to do or the way we used to do it. And here's what I want it to look like and feel like. And sex therapists are a really, really nice opportunity for helping people to create something new again that feels right for them.
I teased this comment earlier, but I want to read it now. This is Rude Diego on YouTube who says, I want the stigma of a sexless marriage to lessen. Sometimes two people love each other, aren't interested in sex, either of them, and express intimacy in different ways. And I think that's a really important thing to acknowledge. And we're looking at a potential positive of this whole sex recession conversation is maybe by talking about this out loud and acknowledging that a lot of us are having less sex than we used to have, that maybe we can make it okay for people so that then they can start that conversation of what they actually want in their lives. And I'm curious if you see that, Debbie, as a potential positive here, just talking about it in open, like, hey, it's not just you. A lot of people are having less sex than 30 years ago.
Yeah, I do. I actually see that as a real positive because there shouldn't be any stigma around people creating the life that works for them and with whatever level of sex or lack of partnered sex. And just because you're not having partnered sex, it doesn't mean you don't have an active imagination or that you can find things like sensual and loving and intimate. But again, it's about what works for a person and checking in every now and then, because what works for you and your partner today may not 3 or 6 months from now.
And Michael on Facebook on this same point is a little bit unhappy that we're even using this term sex recession, which I'll say we did get from the study that we cited at the beginning. But Michael says Americans have a far greater understanding of what sex means to them than the media would like to give them credit for. And they're not interested in meeting an arbitrary and antique set of metrics based on outdated information or moral codes from their parents' and grandparents' generations. Interesting perspective from Michael.
Yeah, so interesting. Because not everybody, and I want to touch on this point, because not everybody was having great sex or sex that they truly enjoyed back in the day. And I want you to touch on that because, you know, now people, and we talked about this a little bit, people have the choice, but not all sex is great sex or wanted sex, right?
No. And that's, I mean, that's why I say, like, I don't want to make the case for sex. I want to make the case for people for, like, taking stock of it for themselves. Because even now, like, some people have some sex that doesn't feel good, that sometimes makes them feel lonely or disconnected or ashamed. And so, you know, when people have sex, if people have sex, what I want for them is that they feel like they can choose sex that they want, that feels the thing that they want to feel, whether that's more connected, beautiful, appreciated. Sometimes people talk about feeling kind of like at one with the universe, you know, just like completely enmeshed with their partner, whatever the case is. And it, and I will say that even when people have sex, it is usually not amazing. So research on sexually satisfied couples finds that most of it is pretty good. There's a whole model of it called the good enough sex model by these two great sex therapists. And it really acknowledges that most of the sex is pretty good. Some of it is meh, like, you know, and then some of it is amazing. And so even with my college students, I say, like, look, most of it's going to be pretty good, and go in with those expectations. And that is like a key to a happier sex life than thinking that most of it is supposed to be mind blowing. Mm.
I would be remiss if we did not mention the overturning of Roe versus Wade, as several of our commenters have brought it up, including Ruth. These trends do predate the overturning of Roe versus Wade. However, I think a lot of people are concerned that that will further contribute to people feeling uncomfortable with sex. And I'm curious, Debbie, if there's anything in the data, anecdotal, that points us in that direction.
Sure. I mean, I hear about it all the time, especially as a college professor, right? I mean, I work with young people, most of whom are not ready to become parents. And many of them, of course, still have strong sexual desire. They are doing the best they can to, you know, use, you know, very strong, effective contraceptives. But I would say what's different is it's not that they're not having sex. I mean, some are, you know, declining sex or having less frequent sex, but it's more often that they are bringing more anxiety to their sex life than I used to see, because they do have that other layer of, well, what if we got pregnant, even though I'm on this like really good contraceptive, like an IUD or something, what if we got pregnant and we're really not ready to get, you know, to have a baby? And where I'm at, right, I'm in Indiana. So, I mean, it would mean like traveling out of state for people who choose to end a pregnancy.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller, Debbie. We have Joe from Quakertown on the line. Joe, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
You know, hi, guys. One thing I'd like to say is, you know, it's always easy to scapegoat economics. But one thing that you need to bear in mind is just inflation. And it's regardless of party, it costs money to go on dates. It costs money to even cook at home. And so that's a factor that weighs heavily on a lot of people's minds when they are considering any form of romantic courtship. Yeah. I'm tired.
Thank you.
So, great call from Joe in Quakertown.
And there were some people on Facebook who were saying, you know, when you're broke, right, and you don't have a lot of money, you don't want a date. And that means, or if you're a couple, it may postpone your decision to get married or move in together or even have children. I mean, does the economy affect desire your sex life?
It absolutely can. But I do always tell people, and I've said this for many years, it doesn't have to. Right. So I get that it often does, but it doesn't have to. And again, you know, being a college professor, most of the people I'm around don't have a lot of money. Right. They're college students and they're working multiple jobs. And so one of the things I've often shared with my students is a list of things that they can do around town that don't cost money if they want to go on a date with somebody. so that they have ideas of things where they can, whether it's for friendships or for dating, they know about hiking trails or taking walks in certain areas, you know, places where they can get more affordable food. But sometimes just giving people that permission, like you can still date even if you don't have like, you know, $50 or $100 for food, because I think some of them think from TV and movies, they're supposed to take somebody out somewhere really expensive. I'm like, you don't have to. The people just, you know, want to be around you, right? So like the person you like just wants to be with you. Mm. And I think for those of us who are old enough to remember the pre-smartphone time, I also try to, like, we college professors often talk about our students don't know what to do with each other. Mm-hmm. So we tell them about like card games. Like, you know, back in the day, we used to like play card games. And if there wasn't anything, you know, we wanted to see, we hung out. Here are some like, you know, word games you can play and stuff like that. And you sort of bring those things back, because otherwise all a lot of, you know, people know how to do these days or have gotten in the habit, even if they know. I know I've said to my husband, like, what did we used to do before Netflix, right?
Yeah,
like, let's
totally
read aloud to each other again.
Yeah.
Let's, you know, let's play games instead of just binge watching a show. So that's how we find time together.
There's one way to look at all this as a very dark signal, that the lack of sex is reflective of a lack of connection, a lack of in-person time, a fact that people don't want to couple or don't find sort of common ground with one another. The other way is to look at this as a signal that there's more choice in society, and that we can create new expectations around this thing that was put into a box for a long time. And I'm curious if you lean toward one of those two, like that this is a good thing, a good sign, or this is a bad sign for society.
I'm not as focused on the frequency of sex, but I am focused on the quality. And I do think that like one of the things I regularly hear from people of all ages is they do lack connection.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I mean, if anything,
that's
if
concerning.
There's an opportunity here, let's look to how we can connect as human beings, spend less time on our devices, not no time, they're part of our lives now, but spend less time and find more opportunities to really connect and like love each other as friends, as partners, whatever. But in an age that we're living through right now, where there's a lot of taking us away from humans and humanity, I think if I lean anywhere, it's toward human connection. Mm.
That was Debbie Herbenik, Provost Professor at the Indiana University School of Public Health and Director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion.
Up next, gray divorce. What's that? We'll be right back.
Our D-I-V-O-R-C-E becomes fine of the day.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Tammy Wynette topped the country charts back in 1968 with that song D-I-V-O-R-C-E. It's about a young couple divorcing and trying to shield their young son from the reality of it. And for a long time, it was a song that captured the face of divorce.
But today, divorce looks different. The divorce rate is actually falling among younger couples, but it's rising among those 65 and up. And according to the most recent data, more than a third of adults going through divorce are now over 50.
In popular media, it's called gray divorce. We explored why it's on the rise and the challenges that come with divorcing later in life with a pair of experts. Lauren Harris is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at the University of New Hampshire. And Andrew Hatherley is a certified divorce financial analyst and host of the Gray Divorce podcast.
We kicked off the conversation with a question about how the culture of older adulthood has really changed since our grandparents or great-grandparents got married. What's different now?
We are living a bit longer, and so we see a lot of older adults are now saying, I don't want to spend the next 30 years with this person. Our great-grandparents might have said, five more years, that's fine. But we're living so much longer. We want a little bit more going on in our life. So there is a part there that older adults today, people in their 50s and 60s are saying, I want a next chapter of my life, and I don't want it to be with this person. Another big piece is that we have empty nesting happening. Mm. And so a lot of older adults are saying, you know, I was staying together for the children. We had these young kids. We were raising them together. We wanted to keep our marriage solid while we were raising children. By the time you hit your 50s, 60s, 70s, those children have launched. They are full adults at this point. They are out on their own. Older adults don't stick together for the children when the children are adults. And they are now in the house by themselves. The children are gone. They're empty nesting. They are now in retirement. They are spending 24 hours a day looking at each other, realizing they don't have a lot in common anymore. They don't get along the way that they used to. They were staying together for the kids. They don't have common interests. They think, I don't want to do this for the next 30 years. I want to be on my own. I want to live the life that is a better fit for me.
Yeah. And Andrew, would love to hear from you as well, because I mean, a lot of circumstances in life have sort of shifted over the past 20, 30 years that makes it easier, I think, for people to even make this kind of decision. Can you give your take on what's happening and discuss those aspects as well?
Yes. First, I wanted to piggyback on something Lauren said. People are living longer and longer, and they're waking up and thinking, you know, maybe I don't want to spend the rest of my life with this person. And that ties in with what we've seen in the growth in the personal development and self-help industry over the last 20, 30 years. I mean, if you look back 20 or 30 years, I can think, okay, Tony Robbins and maybe a couple of other self-help gurus. But now there's dozens of them. People are reading these books and thinking, you know, I've got maybe 20 or 30 years left in my life. You know, I want to maximize it and make the most out of it as possible. But yes, there's a greater acceptance of divorce in society. And I think the baby boomers are very much a divorcing generation. Mm. The growth rates we're seeing now is the baby boomers' age is the over 65 group.
And so one thing we haven't kind of touched on yet is how folks changing financial positions impact this entire conversation. Because if we go back, you know, many decades, I think at this point, there was a sense that people might stay together because they're financially codependent. And I'm sure that's still true in some cases, although I wonder if it's less true than it once was and then how it feeds into this broader trend. Thoughts on that, Lauren?
Yeah, so it's complicated.
Yeah.
But we do know that women have been the instigators of divorce for the past 100 years. Mm. So even when women weren't working outside the home for pay, as we do today, we still saw that women were initiating divorce. But you are right. We have much more financial equality between men and women than we've basically ever had before. And so now women can say, I'm going to leave this marriage. I have my own 401k. I have my own pension. I have my own form of income. I don't need a spouse for that reason. Women can work outside the home still through their 60s, earn money that way. I'm sure we'll talk about, but we see that women have historically taken a bit of a step down in their life circumstances after divorce. We see that women do pay a financial penalty for divorce, but that really is narrowing. And so now older women in their 50s, their 60s, their 70s, when they step back from a marriage, when they divorce, that gap between men and women financially is really narrowing. So there is a big part of it there that women are feeling like they financially can, although historically that hasn't so often held them into the marriage the way that we might think that it has. Hmm.
Yeah, and I know you have a lot to say about the financial stuff, Andrew. Do you want to weigh in here?
Well, certainly, as Lauren mentioned, the fact that women are increasingly, compared to, say, 30, 40 years ago, in the workforce and running large corporations and doing very much better economically independently, that's a contributing factor to gray divorce because they realize that they can look after themselves. Now, there are economic consequences of gray divorce, but there are also social consequences. Mm-hmm. And studies have shown that the economic consequences do, in fact, hit women harder than men. They still hit men hard, but the financial implications for gray divorce are really what make it such a fundamental social issue, mm-hmm. because people don't have the time to recover that they do when they're getting divorced at 65. You know, when you're 30 or 40 and you're getting divorced, you're still going to be working likely for another 30 or 40 years. Your retirement accounts still have a long time to grow. But when you're 2 years or 3 years away from retirement, the implications of what is often the largest financial transaction in our lives are much greater.
I want to talk about marriage and how marriage has shifted and the expectations of what people expect out of a marriage, because maybe what your grandma or great grandma and grandpa expected marriage to be is very different than what people in the current generations expect. Can you sort of explain those differences and how they've shifted?
Yes, of course. Yeah, Cherry, great question. The meaning of marriage and what we expect out of marriage has changed dramatically in the last 100 years or so. So when I think of my own grandparents, they had a little bit more of, we might say like a leave it to beaver kind of marriage, where we had a husband going out and working outside the home for pay. We had a wife staying at home, taking care of the home, raising children. So we had what we call a companionate marriage. It's sort of a team. It's very gendered, breadwinner, husband, stay-at-home mother. And in the last few decades, we've really shifted what we want out of a marriage and what we expect out of a marriage. So young people today, we are looking for more of a individualistic and emotionally expressive relationship. So something where both partners can lean on each other, depend on each other, share the domestic work, share the child rearing, share the breadwinning between the team, that everyone is kind of participating in similar ways. And so I think one of the things that's happening is that older adults are seeing that and thinking, I would like something a little bit more like that. I want my partner to support me. I want my partner to be there for me. I want a friend in my partner. They might be seeing their adult children have those relationships, or their friends have those relationships. Again, one of the reasons we see women tend to initiate divorce is because they want that more friendship. They want that partnership that they're not seeing in their own marriage. And so we've really seen what we want out of a marriage shift from this split gendered teammate companion relationship to much more of a friendship, an emotional bond.
I want to bring in a caller. We have Lisa calling in from Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, wow, Lisa. Wow. You're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So my comment is, first of all, thank you for this, because my mother divorced at age 75 and I divorced at age 55. Certainly financially was a transition and somewhat of a hardship. It was also difficult for our grown children, and I'm including myself in that. Because that is something that you're not necessarily expecting as a grown child to go through at that point. But I would have to tell you that both of us looking in the rearview mirror are saying we're so happy that we did it. It's
wow.
Hard, but it was validating. It's the right thing. As you said in your comments, we don't need someone to take care of us financially. What I'm looking for and wanted was a partner that I could trust and that I could build a life and experience life with, and who was honest with me, and I didn't get that. And so I decided I'm not going to settle for something less. I don't need to. And my mother at 75, people are like, why did she get divorced at 75? What's the point? And the point was, for the next whatever 20, 30 years, whatever she has, she wanted to be happy. She wanted a different life. And just because she had been married, and she got married at age 17, so that's a long time, 17 to 75.
So true.
But to be courageous enough to say, I'm not going to accept this. This is not what I want. I'm going to build a life that I want. I admire her for that. And for my dad, whom I still, love, I'm like, yeah, well, that's what you get, dude. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Lisa.
Lisa from Atlanta, Georgia.
Great call.
Yeah.
Andrew, I'm curious if you had some response to that call. I mean, Lisa covered a lot of ground.
But what stood out to you? Yeah,
that's
fascinating, because I hear that so often. The idea of I want to live my life and I've got this time left. And that ties into what we were talking about earlier about some of the causes. One thing I really wanted to point out, because it's been mentioned a couple of times, is the impact of gray divorce on adult children. I went through my own gray divorce at age 52. And so many people in their 50s or 60s, when they go into an attorney's office, if they go to an attorney's office, and they ask them, do you have any minor children? And they'll typically, if they're older, answer no. Well, the attorney will go check, and then on to the next question. Adult children, now it's not a legal issue for the attorney to get involved in, so you can kind of understand that. But the impact on adult children can be profound.
Yeah.
We're dealing with adult children who can range from 20 to 60, going through so many different life phases. What if a young couple in their 30s or 40s are seeing their parents divorcing while they're going through marital problems of their own? They may ask themselves, my goodness, if mom and dad can't make it, what chance do we have? And so there's all sorts of stresses on adult children.
Let's bring in another caller now. This is Jeanette from University City on the line. Jeanette, you're on Studio 2.
Yeah, hi. We got divorced in our mid-50s, and I'd have to say it has turned out really well, even though, emotionally, I think, is the hard, sticky part. I mean, I was ready. He wasn't. But we both went through couples therapy. So when the time came around, we had talked it all through. And actually, our therapist just, he looked at me and he just said, Jeanette, you don't really want to be married anymore, do you? And that was the watershed, because I had just been unable to say it. Mm. And then once we said it, we worked it through. We did our divorce through a mediator. And now my ex and I are still good friends.
Yeah. And so I guess once you go through the great divorce, Andrew, how do you take the first step? You got to rebuild your life, right? And you heard Jeanette say it worked out great for her, but they did a lot of planning. It sounds like that's a good thing.
Well, it worked out great for Jeanette, and sounds like she really came through the process well. Planning and education is key. You know, when I work with people before, during, and after divorce, you know, we really want to come to a settlement agreement that sets them up on a firm financial foundation for the rest of their life. It's not always going to be as much money, but if you put your life first and adopt maybe a life-centered approach to your financial planning, which is a little different than traditional financial planning, which is all about the money and the number and reaching that number. When you go through divorce, you know, your net worth's dropped, but you're reassessing your life and you're realizing what really brings happiness. And, you know, it's relationships. It's not just exercise or money that bring happiness. It's relationships and connections with others. You can live certainly a happier life after great divorce, if you're following the interests that you may have put aside for many years, if you're getting out in the community or spending more time with your family. But I wanted to point out something that Jeanette said about the emotional component, because it is a key component. And in the divorce world, we've got an expression called divorce brain. And that's when all these emotions are really sadness, anger, resentment. Mm. All these emotions can be playing. I'm a big, big proponent of divorce therapy, licensed marriage family therapist, and divorce coaching.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. We have Leslie from Philly on the line. Leslie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hello. Hello. And thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to say, number one, my parents divorced when I was 13. My dad actually initiated it. And I will say this to you. My father became a better father after that. He didn't move far. You know, everything kind of stayed the same, if you will. And I will say this. I didn't get married as a younger person because I don't think I ever saw my parents organically happy. And so I just really didn't know what those ingredients were. I just knew I didn't want to do that kind of work when I was younger to lead to this place right here, because I wouldn't be a great divorcee. Mm-hmm. However, my question, though, is because now I'm in this space, I'm an empty nester, basically, and I'm looking for, I want kind of connection. And as a 51-year-old, I'm not dating a 22-year-old. So the people that are, you know, men that are in that milieu, if you will, how many of them, or do you have data or any kind of facts on this or thoughts on it? How many of them, these great divorcees, are actually looking to get remarried?
Ooh,
or developed? And what kind of trauma do they suffer, and how quickly do they heal?
Yeah. Leslie from Philly. Good questions.
So I don't know who wants to raise their hand and take a crack at that. There's a lot there. Andrew, why don't you go ahead and help Leslie out.
I don't have any statistics on the number of great divorcees that remarry. But what I will say is that second marriages have even higher divorce rates than first marriages.
Yeah.
And third marriages have even higher divorce rates than second marriages. So this is actually another contributing factor to the incidence of divorce among older people, is that sometimes it's a second or third marriage which have higher incidence of divorce than first marriages.
Yeah, Lauren, what did you? Yeah, I think you wanted to add something to that conversation.
So yeah, absolutely. So my work in older adults is actually in older adult repartnering more so than the divorce and the split up. So I very much just sit in a world of people in their 50s, 60s, 70s looking for a partner. So I could talk about this all day. you know, it's complicated in that about 15% or so of older adults are actively looking for a new partner. Casually looking, it kind of gets gray, like what is looking? So the definitions are a little hard here. I will say part of the issue for older adult repartnering is the gender ratio imbalance. So by the time you hit age 60, there's about 1.5 times more women than there are men. By that time you hit 75, there's about 3.5 times more women than there are men. age demographic. So the older you get, it, for women, it does get harder. For men, they have a great time. They have lots of opportunity. But there are a number of really great people out there looking for a new relationship. For a lot of people, so Andrew's talking about the divorce rate gets higher. It does. For every subsequent marriage, the divorce rate goes up. One of the other things, though, is a lot of older adults aren't looking to get remarried. They are looking for a companion. They are looking for someone to go to dinner with, to travel with, to spend a weekend gardening, maybe celebrate holidays. A lot of people are looking for more of a companion, maybe living together, maybe not. Really popular for older adults is what we call living apart together. So having a long-term committed relationship, and you each have your own homes, like your own space, do your own thing. And so that tends to work pretty well for older adults. So there are a lot of opportunities. You don't have to go into this thinking, I need to get married, or everybody wants to get married. If that's something you want, then that's great. And if that's not something you want, that's okay too. There are a lot of choices.
That was Lauren Harris. She's a professor of human development and family studies at the University of New Hampshire.
We also heard from Andrew Hatherly, a certified divorce financial analyst and host of the Great Divorce Podcast. Thanks for joining us today for this look back at some intriguing romance trends of 2025.
Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Today's episode was edited and produced by Paige Murray Bessler. Al Banks and Diana Martinez engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory.
From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you tomorrow.